Hello, Austin. Hello, Texas. Hello, South by Southwest. This is the first time we have a panel from European Tech Art here. We all come from Europe. I mean, the two of us, you know, we bring cool stuff, but nobody leaves before we finish because it's something that, something that is in a way new. You know, it's new kind of art. Of course, you've seen it here, but I don't think you see enough European art. So we're going to bring it and show it to you, talk to you about it. Now, in some way, we're bringing a little Italy here from Turin, Italy. It's close to Milano, as opposed to Milano, which is a fashion and money center. Torino is different. It was the first capital of Italy 150 years ago. Then it was famous because it was the city of Fiat, but since it was also the Olympic Game city, but for many years and then it was a city where Fiat was produced. It was an industrial city, rather ugly, but important for the social changes that it brought. And now that Fiat is all over the world, it came back to its origins. It was also the first capital of cinema. And now it's back to its becoming a cultural capital of Italy and maybe even of Europe. It's also the capital, the only capital of the world of black and white magic. I don't want to say anything more about that, except that Nietzsche went mad there. Italo Calvino was born there. And now it's the center of cyberculture, of electronic art, in specific of Share Festival, which you're going to talk about today. My name is Jasmina Tešanović, and I'm a Serbian, Italian, American, feminist, author, activist. Okay? But one thing that puts me together is that I'm an internet person, and I don't want to be anywhere else but online and do all the cool stuff online. Now, my guest tonight, is Simona Lodi.
Hi.
She is the art director of Share Festival, which is an electronic art festival, international electronic art festival from Turin, Italy. She's the founder of the festival, and she's going to speak about this event. We have a special guest today. He needs no presentation because he is your Austin boy, author, Bruce Sterling. Right now, he often spends his time in Torino, too, so he's also from the Torino crew, I would say, today. And why is he connected to Share Festival? He's connected because some years ago, in 2008 precisely, he was the curator of the special edition. It was called Make. He brought a lot of American culture to Torino Share Festival. And ever since then, he never left. You know, me too. So basically, we are part of the Torino Share crew. And we wanted to approach today's panel from a larger point of view to speak about what is tech art, because it's really a new discipline, but it's in a way it's also old discipline, and especially if you speak from the point of view of European country like Italy, which was always the center of many old-fashioned arts, and also because I come from a country which has fallen apart, Yugoslavia, Serbia, I come precisely. And I remember vividly, you know, I was young in the 60s. I mean, I don't remember that, but I remember in the 70s, the very, very vivid and lively performance art scene that which we had in Belgrade. Names like Marina Abramović started in Belgrade, in Zagreb. And Zagreb is precisely the city which was ex-former Yugoslavia city, the capital and the beginning of the tech art scene. Now, I will ask, before showing you a little movie which we have about Share Festival and the prizes that were delivered there, and the artists showing their work, which is going to be much better than all the words we can deliver here, I wanted to ask two questions to my guests. The first, I will start with Bruce, not because he's from Austin, but because he's American, because he can give you like a larger view on this question that bothers us all the time, and it is this one. Yes. Why is there so much tech art in Europe and so little in US? And it's not about money. It's really not about money. You wouldn't believe it, but it's not about money.
Is this one live here?
No, it's the seventh one is live.
All right, great. Hi there.
So I'm not officially here as Bruce Sterling, but in my alter ego as Bruno Argento. grumpy European tech art critic. And, you know, there are areas where tech art tends to spring up, and they spring up in areas where there's tech and there's art, and when there's some kind of overlap there and some kind of niche where people can do it. And these niches are sometimes in exceedingly odd places. Like, it's actually true that Zagreb in Yugoslavia was the first place to have kind of officially sanctioned computer art, because there were a bunch of guys hanging around at some Yugoslav tech university, and they thought computers were important, so they like had some, but they didn't really have any industries to which to apply them, so they just started like coming up with like weird graphics programming and publishing it and actually sort of creating a scene where people could look at one another's work and sort of take this seriously and, get shows and get paid and acquire some kind of artistic reputation. So, you know, the world doesn't lack for hackers and geeks and people who like to do odd things with electricity. The answer to the question is, like, why is there so much in Europe and not very much in the U.S. is that there's some kind of social capital there, so that Europeans will kind of naturally cluster together and praise one another and give one another some impetus. So there are certain areas in Europe that have been very friendly to this. Amsterdam, home of the Dutch Electronic Art Festival, London, Rotterdam, Torino, of course, Milano, which is a big center of Italian cyberculture, home of Wired Italia, among other publications, and then the world capital of electronic art, which oddly enough is Linz, Austria. You know, and why Linz? Well, it's the home of this over 30-year-old festival, Ars Electronica, which is kind of the South by Southwest of electronic art. And it's a dinky little town. And the experience of being a guy in Linz is a lot like being an Austinite during South by Southwest. During this particular period, once a year, during Ars Electronica, the town's just freaking invaded with electronic arts people, mostly from Europe, but a lot from Asia, some from the U.S., and increasing numbers out of South America. And they have been at it for decades, and they have a museum, and they sort of have the full backing of their city council, and the population is friendly toward it because it's sort of what Linz is famous for, and it's just become a hotbed of this stuff. There's not a lot of art created there because they don't really have enough to make people happen, but it's sort of, it's judged there and it's curated there. And I don't think there's any realistic likelihood that another city will be able to beat Linz at doing this. So they were kind of first out of the chute. They've got a first adopter advantage. They've got social backing. They've got some government backing. There's money around and you can get kind of famous doing it. So that's why. That's why European tech art is really globally dominant.
Okay, so the next question will be for Simona. Which are the main institution, museum, resources? So Simona will speak in English.
Yeah, I speak in English, but my English is not native English. I am Italian, so yes, it will be, funny English. I invent world in English, I mix with language, this is not the point. Europe has a long history about institution and festival and events related to school, related to art and technology. The oldest one is Ars Electronica in Linz in Austria. This build that you are looking in the picture is the bigger museum built 4 years ago in Linz, totally dedicated to technological art. When I start to present to my city, to Torino, my project on Share Festival, about what we can, you say we can say tech art, digital art, net art, the electronic art. There is so many definition. I go there with my project and they say, what? What is art and internet? art and technology, new technology, digital technology. So it was a fight also in Italy and in the mainstream of contemporary art, because they refused in a way what's happened for video art in the 70s. You know, that Nam June Paik started to use video, but nobody recognized video art as art. So it was just not only a proposal, it's just a kind of mission for me to do this this festival. And Ars Electronica in Linz inspired me and a lot of people in Europe, because they have a long story, more than 30 years. And now they were pioneer of a lot of stuff. They do everything in Europe, from the first experiment to the bio art, to hybrid art, and they are now dedicated a lot of exhibition to the bio art. That means to connect the biology with the technology, and it's very impressive, because it's more than body art. That is, it's more than performing art. It's connected with science, and it's arise a very ethic problem, for example. And I want to mention it only four or five events, because it's good. Well, yeah, we should need many days to speak about all the story of tech art in Europe. The second one is in Berlin. Berlin is a very laboratory city now. Now, not now, since 20 years, when the walls fall down, and they invest a lot of money on a lot of research on culture experiment and especially culture related to technology. So in Berlin there is a Transmediale, and this year's Transmediale has his 25th edition. Especially Transmediale, the characteristic of this very big festival is more related to activism and e-government or new formula for democracy. The political issue in Germany for their past is always a largest debate. So it's always interesting to go there and to hear what's happened in this field, especially, you know, new kind of participation, new kind of involve people to government themselves through internet. And the artist works in tactical media more than other place.
So it's also a social event, you're saying. That's more a social event.
Yes,
in Berlin, related, Transmedia.
Yes,
yeah.
More related with social
participatory
problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
More related with the social problem than other festival. I speak about this kind of art thinking that you know what is the mainstream contemporary art system. They are totally out of the problem of the society. They're totally out of the problem of the use of technology. And they are thinking all about money and business. No. So we are there is a huge debate, what is art and what is not art. If the market is a sign for to decide if it's good fine art or not. Okay. We are not thinking about speaking about art that you can sell or buy, because
I think that's a very old problem. You know, what's art, what's not art. It's like, it's, you know, really, it's embedded in the term of what of art. You know, but I think that problem becomes very acute with tech art. I mean, the idea, if you see something on the screen which is like some waves which are just making noise, how can you tell if it's just garbage or mistake of a hacker? You know. Or something which has some concept behind, some relevance. I mean, I'm asking this question just like an audience, like a user, like an artist, you know, and you're curators, the two of you, you know. Can you answer, both of you, to this question before we show our you know, because every time when we get this material as a jury, you know, and we get like thousands of entries of people who send you something, you know, you really, you know, the dividing line between something which is nothing and something that is like great stuff, you know, it's very, very, very little, you know, very close. Okay, who's going to answer that first?
Yeah. So we are speaking about transmediale and the social problem involved.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, shortly. I want to speak also to another pioneer festival, that is DEAF, Dutch Electronic Art Festival. Dutch Electronic Art Festival restarted this year for 3 years of stop because they changed, they became so big and they opened a school and they do very interesting things. And their particularity is that the festival are an open lab. No, this is another characteristics for this kind of exhibition. This festival are not the white box in which you put the artworks in the wall and the people go to see and go away and you have a line and you follow the line and you follow the queue. The one of what all the festival, also mine, is to involve people to participate in a very concrete way. And you can choose your parcours. You can go where you want. You can find where it is just a sampler sometimes. There is not a team. There is especially something that you do. During the test, it's an experience fundamental. The last one that I want to speak to you, to do it shortly, is Sonar. It's in Spanish, and Sonar is the huge festive music electronic festival in Europe, and they start from music. But after a few years, they understand that it's not possible to do electronic music, electronic music without related art. So they open their festival to other art. And this is the meaning of all this festival and also mine. There is not two different way. On one hand, there is art and music and designer and architect and the people that do creative stuff. And on the other hand, there is scientists and technical people. There is the third paradigm. And this festival wants to prove that this third paradigm is the paradigm of the new era.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So,
right. Well, yeah. To address the question of how do you tell good tech art from bad tech art, it is something I owe to Simona because, you know, I'm a writer and a blogger and I spend a lot of time paying attention to tech art. I'm always interested in weird stuff people do with technology. But in doing, you know, in actually being curator of a tech art event and then hanging out on juries of other tech art events, you're challenged by getting like 600 pieces of tech art and having to pick six, which means you have to like come up with ways to get rid of 594 pieces of tech art. And it's really interesting, you know, and involving because, you know, it's like being an editor at a magazine and then selecting six stories out of a slush pile of 600. So, you know, the thing that's good about it is that it's actually very popular. I mean, if you put on a tech art event, people will show up. like 7 to 77. Kids like it. Granny's sort of okay about it. You can fund it. They're exciting to see. It's new. It's very of our time. It really speaks to people who are, you know, carrying around devices in their daily lives and so forth. The difficulty with it is that it's very scattered. There isn't really a city in the world that has just like a tech art region in the way that like Paris has like a place where you can go be a painter, or Los Angeles has a place where you can go be a filmmaker. There really isn't a kind of central tech art place. There's like one or two important tech artists, maybe a cluster of a few. But you know, even the groups that are clustered are very widespread, like, say, Free Art and Technology Lab, which is a sort of guild of tech art guys, including, like, Aaron Bartol and, Golan Levin, but spread across many, many different societies and kind of united in an electronic scene. So I guess the easiest thing to do would be sort of say, okay, it's great art if you're famous, but that would mean that Olafur Eliasson is the most famous tech artist in the world. And he does a little bit of tech art, but mostly he just does light installations with like prisms, mirrors, and so forth. And he really wouldn't identify himself as a tech art. Or you could say that it like matters a lot if you're a critic, in which case being in the Museum of Modern Art in New York and having your work picked out by Paola Antonelli would be really important. No. But, you know, those are really simple things, and they don't enliven up the scene. What you see in tech art, I mean, how do you tell if it's bad? It's bad if it reinvents the wheel, and that happens a lot. Somebody has a great idea, and they go into their garage, and they build something, and they don't realize it was built in 1957 in Switzerland by Jean Tanguay, right? Because they're not hip to what's gone on, and they don't understand the long history of these things. And, you know, and there really isn't a sort of central place where you can check up and see if your idea's been done again. So you get the wheel reinvented a lot. You get really clever guys involved in tech art who tend to do very arcane, weird, cranky kinds of things. They're, like, very important to maybe five other people. And are not going to get any kind of popular traction. So those are really sort of like more like weird lab experiments and not really very artistic. You get a certain amount of stuff which is just kind of simple-minded and amateurish. And, you know, just not very well put together. It's haywire. It's not going to work. You can generally look at it, you know, okay, there's a guy who tried to engineer something. He's not really an engineer. You get things that are old-fashioned, but I think really, how do you tell the real answer to that question is like, how do you tell good tech art from bad tech art? Is like in a lot of other lines of art production, it's really the judgment of your peers over a long period. I mean, who is it that's done something and it turns out to be more important 10 years from now than it was when he did it?
So basically, it's the context also we're talking.
Yeah, you know, it's typical of an art scene. I mean, it's actually kind of typical of, like, how do you know who did good software? Because there's, like, a lot of programmers around, but there aren't many programmers around who are, like, really genius programmers, inventing new algorithms, breaking new ground, finding new applications. You know, and there isn't sort of a giant software approval board where somebody gets the Nobel Prize for software.
Okay, so now we're going to show you...
Yes, I'm totally agree with Bruce. Mm-hmm. You explained very well. Mm-hmm. And I want to add that technology is a language, is a medium, and it is a subject. And when the artist mm-hmm. use the technology in these three ways, this is again, an experiment in art. Mm-hmm. And maybe they spend more time to do a really a finished work, but we are in the progress. Mm-hmm. So, but yes, as you say,
we're going to show you now the share prize winners and the honorary mentions. And while there's Simone is going to explain a little bit, and maybe also Bruce, while the silence going on.
I want to say just this: share prize. It's a curator. How you say shelter? Choose. una scelta,
it's a choice.
It's a curatorial choice, sorry, because I refuse really to create exhibition with the title in which artist has to have a gallery for to present themselves, has to be, have a parkour that is not directly involved in the festival. Share Festival is an open call, and this is perfect for our festival because the artists can be involved directly in the festival, not passing through curators. So it's also it's the same, something that is not important. But in mainstream art, you depend. The artists depend of the art director of the museum and of the curator and of the journalist and how many you sell and of gallery and so on. This is different. So the people can apply. To the share prize and be selected. So
this is also at the end we will give a call to all of you, you know, and we will give the rules about the next share prize, you know. But what she's pointing out, and I think it's like generally goes for this new technology, you know. The thing is like as it changed the rules, the social rules of books and publishing, you know, and which I really like, you know. I won't speak about the negative side, but on the other hand, the same thing happened in art, you know, that you really skip over some social instance that there is more democracy.
Okay.
Go ahead. Now we're going to show. It started seven, how many years? But we're showing you only the last one, yeah? Come on.
Yeah. This was a performance, and this girl is an actress. And this performance is called Human Browser. The people asked to search engine something, and she repeat exactly what the search engine transmitted to her. So it was the opening of the festival, and she went around, and the people asked to her to answer. And it was a human machine in different interaction. If you, Bruce, I have something to say about.
You'd really
some
like
piece.
Paolo Cirio. He's a mainstay of the Italian tech art scene. Paolo's. A hacker, and he likes to do intervention art, and he's been known to torment Facebook and Amazon. Amazon Noir was a media hack in which he came up with a piece of software that assembled all the snippets out of Amazon books and then re-glued them back together as the actual books.
Yeah.
And of course, he got a cease and desist letter, which is kind of the ultimate accolade for an intervention of this kind. You want the lawyers to show up and give you a lot of free publicity. But he is together with his colleague Alessandro Ludovico, who is the editor, by the way, of an excellent tech art magazine. He has been known to do these kinds of. Annoying interventions or brilliant political commentaries. You can kind of take your choice there.
Yeah, of course they have a legal fight with Amazon, and because they published all the book they are stolen, and it's for they are fighting for free knowledge, and they have a trouble. And it was a kind of really activism.
Yeah, this is Delicate Boundaries by Christine Sugru.
Just a moment. Okay, I want to restart from the.
As soon as does the tracking of this
right.
Can relate to the screen
because you can see the name of this artist. Okay.
There we go. Yes, this was the winner during the Share Festival, in which I happen to be the curator. It's a work of augmented reality called Delicate Boundaries by Christine Sugru. It was in a small booth, and it had an animation on a computer screen, and as you reached out and touched it like this, the icons, the pixel little devices, sprites inside the screen would migrate out onto the hands of the users. You know, I must have seen 100,000 people interact with this piece. Never once did they look up to realize that it was just sort of a simple video projector on the ceiling that had, you know, just been sort of connected to the back. I would explain that to people. But, you know, the metaphor of having bugs crawl out of the screen and onto your hands was so incredibly powerful that nobody realized it. It was just sort of a simple piece of augmented stage magic. Just like taking the scene and like looking at it from 90 degrees, you know, with a very simple kind of outline recognition unit. But, you know, we were very happy to give Christine the Share Prize, and I think it gives people credibility in what's really a rather scattered scene. You can go back to Madrid or San Francisco or Sao Paulo or wherever and say, I've got the prize, you know, and it's a little bronze gong in your hands. And it enables you to raise money for your next issue. It's something that the press can talk about. It's just kind of a fun enabling thing and really one of the mainstays of distributing, credibility. She did get some money for her prize, and she immediately told us that she would invest the money in her next tech art piece.
Okay, we have a sound problem because we don't hear the sound. Right, our tape is not getting the output.
But we can go on.
Oh, we must go on.
We must go on.
Okay. The show must go on.
Explain what's happening.
No, you just go on. At least we have, you will explain it. You know, we don't have the sound of the artist talking about it, you know.
That's all right. You could look
we
up
did
Christine
this one.
Online.
Finish them. Go ahead.
S-U-G-R-U-E.
Press Scotchy of it.
Like this.
Just, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead. Go to the next one, Simon.
This is the knife hand chop bot.
This was the very popular knife hand chop bot installation. This is an exceedingly violent piece of work where a literal kitchen knife on a kind of piston jabs the spaces between your fingers. Now, it had a hand recognition algorithm written in so that the point of the blade would never supposedly hit your hand. But as you put your hand out, at first it began stabbing rather slowly. But if you didn't jerk it back, it would like ramp up and begin dicing over your hand more and more rapidly until, you know, people would eventually panic or the artist would intervene. And, you know, most people panicked. They really could not handle the sight of this blade going up and down with, you know, tremendous mechanical speed. There was never an injury of any kind. It wasn't really that dangerous. I mean, unless you moved your hand, then it would be troublesome in some way.
No. Okay, we don't need the light. We have good feeling. Oh, okay.
Okay, that's good.
Finally, okay. It's always the technical problems. With tech art, you always have technical
problems.
Tech art
always breaks down. You particularly didn't want this one to break because of the large... You know, and it was popular because people would watch the viewer go up and risk his hand. There was always somebody willing to do it. So it really made you wonder. But it was really quite a successful installation, and you know, safer than it looked.
Yes, Andrea Muxel with Connect.
Raise it up.
What?
Louder. Più forte.
This is the maximum.
No, it's just not outputting.
Okay, explain.
This guy's installation was actually considerably more physically dangerous than the knife hand chop bot. He's a guy from Bremen who, like, during the long winter months, retires into his basement and builds these bizarre machines. And this one involved swinging steel balls on long pieces of thread. They were sort of throwing a magnet from one piece to another. And, you know, I think this is a big trend in tech art. You know, the trend of the 90s was to do stuff on screens or with CD-ROMs or on the internet with webs. But nowadays we're getting much more in the way of physical art and interactive physical art. And sort of the bigger, the better, and the louder, the better received. So, you know, this guy's installation was also exceedingly popular. You know, it really had a poetic quality as these magnets flew from one piece of flying steel ball to another. But it was also quite dangerous. I mean, you could have cracked somebody's head open with one of these flying devices.
The good thing we have Bruce, huh? Who is explaining. The audio is not working.
I really spent quite a long time watching this thing. You know, it was like more soothing than a screensaver in some ways. And you know, I think there have been technical trends that sort of determine whether a thing like this can be done. There's been a lot of shared software, but now there's more in the way of shared instructables. People are coming up with ways to teach one another how to make big installations.
And he's using Arduino, you see? He's like explaining now how he's using Arduino and how it's easy for...
Yeah, there's a guy from Ivrea, which is a small town in northern Italy, named Massimo Bonzi, who's kind of the darling of the make scene and has invented this microcontroller along with six of his colleagues called the Arduino. And the effect of this device has really been revolutionary in tech art. I've never seen a particular thing that like made more difference on the ground than this Arduino microcontroller.
Next one.
Ralph Baker, calculating space. But I cannot.
Oh yeah, that's the one that involved the rubber bands and Okay, this guy built a gigantic physical computing device that was using the tension between elastic threads and metal moving arms to do actual calculations. So it was doing, I don't know, maybe 2K of processing, but the thing was huge. I mean, really big. Now here he goes.
Oh, fine.
This is completely done with strings. If two strings are pulled, the outgoing line is pulled too. And this is the whole concept. And the machine runs the program, but the program is not software, but the program is inscribed or it's in the connections of the machine, like how the lines are connected, how the parts are connected, which builds the program. The program is a cellular automaton, which is a simple program that generates complex patterns of behavior.
Oh, by the way, Stephen Wolfram, who's the world master of cellular automata, is having a presentation during our presentation. It's hard to describe how mesmerizing this thing was in public. You know, I mean, you really had to be there, which is sort of what makes these events work. But people would stand there and stare at it for half an hour as it just sat there calculating and making this bizarre, rather musical, hissing noise as it went about it. I mean, the sound design really counted for a lot in this guy's installation. It was so huge and intricate and yet delicate and almost sort of sinister.
And it worked.
Oh, yeah, and it worked. You know, it worked really, it ran really dependably for
The criteria.
The entire presentation.
The criteria in the jury, one of the criteria is like you have really cool stuff, but you say, is it going to work on the ground? Like, it's one of really important things that you have to know, like the sound. I mean,
really? How many blackouts and system crashes are you going to have? I mean, I have sat there with my fellow jurists sort of like trying to calculate the mean time between failures of the components. That's one of the reasons it's still rather a frontier effort.
This is Ernesto Clarna.
Oh, yeah.
Derelation and light. This is one of my favorite because it's about the perception of the space from the audience. And this light, you can are in interaction with the light.
That was a beautiful interaction metaphor. It had no moving parts. There were no buttons to push. There was nothing to set up. You just walked into a a dimly lit room, rather like this one, and a curtain of light would appear, and then bend and moan as you got closer to it.
Yeah, you can move the light when how you want, and Ernesto wins that years.
Yeah, he really won. I mean, to watch people interact with this thing was fascinating. They would split up by generations. A 3-year-old would charge in there headlong, you know, and an 80-year-old would wait until somebody else had shown how it works. But then eventually they would go in and do it. Every person who saw this thing had to touch the light. They had to go in there and somehow bend it. I never saw anybody just give it a cursory glance and leave. It was a piece of interactive art where every person I saw somehow was driven to interact with it. And it worked beautifully. Yeah, never a moment of downtime.
Yeah, and here really film cannot do it justice. The experience is much more complete, you know, when you go there and live it.
It's really immersive.
Mm-hmm. Oh, here there is a
microphone.
Yeah, here there is the formigas. That is Honduras means ants, and it's an installation very completely because the ants that live in this box, it's we can call it bio art or hybrid art because mix different things, lively animals and DJ performing. So the ant became the DJ of this installation.
Mm-hmm. He brought the ants from his country. Eh? They traveled.
This and is face to Facebook, and it was 1 million stolen Facebook profiles.
This is Paolo Cirio once again predating on large monopolistic online entities. He's also the guy who did Amazon Noir, and this is his attack on Facebook, which also won him a stiff cease and desist letter from Facebook's many lawyers.
Yeah.
But they robbed, they systematically robbed a whole bunch of Facebook profiles and then set up a black market dating site where their yes, it was very amusing. It was set up for kind of maximum cognitive dissonance along that line.
He's planning to do banks next.
Yeah, he's going to push the limit.
Occupy the banks.
Our Paolo is like determined to like step over the line by whatever means necessary.
Yeah. He's like the hacker, artist, activist. He's like really, really incredibly multi-talented and multifaceted artist, you know.
And he has a lot of fight with legal
issues, you can only imagine.
This is honorary mention the next week. This is an activist.
People don't think that. They're looking for that. They're much easier to propaganda. They're not just the genius of our media.
No, this is very interesting.
This is a very interesting. It's a plug that these two artists program and install in the Wi-Fi cafe, like Starbucks or something like this. And we can call it tactical media works, because as you see, they are showing how they do this. And then this is a normal plug that they put in the bar or in the place that with the Wi-Fi. And if you connect your iPad or your computer on the newspapers online. Yeah. You can read, I don't want to. They modified by filters. New news, and it's about how to manipulate the media and how the media manipulate us.
Yeah, just pay them back.
And it was really incredible works, very activist.
Yeah, it's basically a $40 box that plugs into the wall.
Yeah, lights, please, now. No, not yet. Sorry. No, mine now.
What?
Il mio.
Yes. Now we come back. Just a moment.
Well, most threw you out.
Yes.
Okay.
Speaking of acting.
Yes, because, I mean, also Jasmina is doing she is a lot of talent, and one is to be activist.
Being also a political activist, you know, and also an artist, I always thought that the fact that we have internet, we can do a lot of stuff. We can, of course, you know all that, you know, Twitter and all that stuff, but we can do also art. Now, this is a performance thing, art that women perform, which I this was part of my conceptual activism in the 70s, as in Belgrade, you know. And all of a sudden, with the internet, it became really a completely different issue, much larger, international, like globalized. I mean, I started doing it like first in Torino with Simona, and it's like a concept of some kind of coming out of women in front of the camera. They don't know what they're going to be asked and what they're going to be asked to do. And then we did it also in Austin. We continued in Austin. And we also plan to perform it in Brazil and also in Serbia. I'm not going to tell you the details, but the point is the ultimate thing would be to have a seven-screen gallery where the audience can interact with these performances by pressing the buttons on topics, on words, and also these words and that the women are saying transform into music by special program that an electronic musician did. But however, this is only a sample of these performances we did. What I really would like to do, and this would be in combination with other share people from REF, a fake factory publisher, who's a publisher online, where you upload all over the world these women performing, you know, so I don't have to be there. They would just upload their own performances, and with special programs, they will be able to edit them, mix them, and you know, get to know each other. And because when we did it for the first time in Torino, I was surprised that people came up to me and asked me, "Can they do the performance with me?" So. What I like about this is that every event, like Share Festival or like this, at the end can be also a place where we do some laboratory and do something concrete. So at the end of this panel, I'm asking if somebody wants to do this performance. We are ready. We have the crew here. And when a woman, we need a woman who wants to have a performance called Women Perform in Austin. Okay, I think we need a light now to go on with this. Light, please. Okay, I would like to, we have some more time. I would like to ask Bruce now, European cyber art is different from American cyber art, if American cyber art exists at all. But we talked about this, and you said if there is a parallel, the parallel would be American hacker culture. And you, as an expert on American hacker culture, you can tell us something about that.
Well, it's actually Stephen Levy, who's also here at South by Southwest, who's about a world expert on hacker culture. But you know, traditionally, I think what sort of unites these things is their means of production. Because if you were a hacker like MIT in the 50s, basically you were grabbing stuff that had been built for some other purpose and using it to like teach yourself or to show off your technical skills. And traditionally, tech art has been tech. That technicians have somehow transmuted into art. And they've just sort of done that by any means necessary. And commonly, they use junk. Either leftover stuff, or maybe stuff from a school, something sitting around that hasn't been there, that has sort of been perverted to another purpose. And that has been a very big part of this kind of net art campaigns, the news tweak and so forth, or attacks on Facebook and Amazon. It's some clever, technically talented person using the tools of technology to make some kind of artistic statement, commonly in a way that's kind of confusing or disruptive or subversive. So that's why hacker culture in the U.S. is rather similar to tech art culture in the net art scene. However, unlike the past 5 or 6 years, seven, I guess, in some cases. We've actually seen tools which are being created by tech artists specifically for the purpose of tech art. And there are two of them, Processing, which was invented at MIT by Ben Fry and Casey Rees, and this Arduino microcontroller, which is invented in Italy by Massimo Bonzi and his colleagues. And these are the first devices, the first means of production, which was specifically made for tech art purposes by tech artists. And they interoperate. They're potentially like the Wintel of the tech art world. You finally got a kind of open source, artistically built software platform along with a microcontroller device that's specifically designed for use by artists. And this is a really big deal. I mean, it may not be that Processing or Arduino are the end game there, but it's the first time that people have been doing tech art with just real tech art stuff, you know, and like uniting as groups to sort of develop these platforms and these abilities and sort of like use them synergistically to do new things. In other words, it's finally a sign of tech art seizing the means of production instead of being the sort of poor nephew who's like using hand-me-downs and repurposing other stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I consider that like a really optimistic development and a new and exciting thing. And there's another trend that I think is like very much on the side of tech art, and that's Kickstarter. If you look at what Kickstarter has done over the past year, it's actually distributed more money for creative projects than the National Endowment of the Arts in the U.S., okay, if Kickstarter is going to be bigger than the NEA, it's not going to be long before most American art is Kickstarter art. And Kickstarter doesn't ask, is it art? Does it belong in the Smithsonian? It's more like, I've got this cool idea to like build a statue, or I want to like do this like weird kind of pair of interactive shoes. I mean, the stuff that's coming through Kickstarter is very hackerly and very tech art, and it's finding an audience, and it's even finding financing, which has been a serious problem in the tech art scene, because unlike most forms of art, you can't really buy it. Now, if you buy a painting, you can usually hold on to it for 100 years. If you know how to take care of a painting, you can resell it to somebody else. A piece of software art, it's very hard to value that. There's no collector scene. There isn't this sort of, situation where a guy who's got $20 million buys $5 million worth of art, dies, and gives it to a museum. Okay, that phenomenon doesn't really exist in tech art. The objects are very frail. Commonly, the guy who built it or programmed it is the only guy who knows how to make it work. So there hasn't really been a good, solid economic underpinning for this kind of art to flourish. You can't collect it. You can't buy it. There isn't a market. The most you can do is kind of like move it around in a wagon and show it out on the road.
And it's also a problem how to preserve it.
Even Nam June Paik, who's world's most famous video artist, built his video for analog vacuum tube Sony televisions. And they're just plain falling apart. Yeah. You're not going to be able to run the video and so forth. So these are organizational problems, but there's also organizational responses. And Kickstarter is like one of these. It's just like, okay, we're kind of a network society now, and we like really cool gizmos, and like we've got like built a gigantic, cool, arty gizmo machine, bigger than the NEA in a matter of a few years. And now similar Kickstarter things are showing up at places like Brazil, Mexico, areas that were sort of off the fine arts map. The future for this kind of effort looks really big. I'm not going to say it's bright, because tech art is kind of a strange, dodgy, punker, hackerly thing to do. But it looks brighter pretty much than any form of conventional analog art. I mean, almost every one of the other ones is in some kind of retreat mode or kind of hiding from a ceaseless rain of cultural assaults. Whereas tech art actually is like getting through to people who know how to do it, and like winning new adherents every day.
Speaking of which, we'll end up with Simona explaining how to involve you, in the next future SharePrize festival where you can send your work or,
Yes, this is a useful information. Yeah. I distribute this card, and you can see here the share price, the sixth edition, April from 15th of March, and you have three months to apply. And there will be a jury and a jury member. All information is online. And the issue of this 8th edition of Share Festival will be Open Your City, because Torino has a project as candidate city for became a smart city in Europe. And we are one of the most polluted city in Italy. So we have to do something.
I think we are the most polluted city. Yeah. Not one of them.
No way.
In Europe, we are
Naples
second. In Europe, we are second. In Italy, we are one. Yeah.
Yeah. The one. Mm-hmm. So please take, if you are interested in it, take this and remember to this call. And in this corner of this table, there is other free material from produced from Share Festival.
DVDs,
take
music,
this, especially the last catalog of the last edition of the Share Festival that is dedicated to appropriation, and was called Cops and Robbers. And
we have a couple of more minutes for a question, for questions, you know, somebody wants to ask. Yeah, there is a question, yeah. Yeah. I don't hear anything. I'm deaf, by the way.
We need maybe a microphone.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we have two questions we can answer. Yeah?
So I'm curious, in the case of these works that attract negative legal attention from... large entities, what sort of resources the artists have to defend themselves or to engage in these court suits? I mean, I would imagine it's...
Well, it almost never goes to court. I mean, except in the case of eToys, which had sort of a famous...
Yeah.
It had a famous dust-up with a .com called eToys. And they did, in fact, take it to court. But, of course, they immediately found pro bono lawyers who were more than happy to defend them. And I mean, you know, when it comes to a thing like face-to-face book, Amazon Noir, or the Facebook suicide machine, they're perfectly aware that they're looking at people who are feeding on publicity, and that any lawsuit that actually hits the newspapers is going to explode to the art press. So, you know, the cease and desist letters are basically just they're a gesture. Mm-hmm. They never go to court over this because they don't want to give the artists the public eye and ear.
They choose more best lawyer than best gallerist.
And nowadays, if you actually prosecuted a guy like Paolo Cirio, you'd have, like, anonymous all over your case.
Yeah.
You know, and dozens of other people would copy his code and go out and, like, you know, raise every kind of holy hell.
Yeah, they want to be provocative, but not to go.
Another question? Sorry, I'm...
Okay, hi. A couple quick comment and then a question. I think that I understand that Kickstarter has funded quite a few artists, but I think it's also important to note out that a lot of the funding from Kickstarter, what people raise money on from the general public, has actually been industrial design products rather than particular artworks. I mean, people can use that to ask their friends and family, but it usually comes out to that your friends and family give you money, and then the ones that the mass public usually put money into happens to be industrial design product. And then the question I had that you didn't sort of bring up, I was wondering if you had any comment or conversation on, is the way that the product Connect has really transformed a lot of the tech art, because I see that as an incredibly fast moving trend. And when it was first released, like within 6 months, the artist community took it, hacked it, made an open source software, and now tons of projects are being made out of it. So I wanted you to comment on that.
Yeah, you know, I think there are certain devices that are more inherently more art friendly than others, and Connect is one of them, because it's sort of like very body like and you know, and it sort of works in the 7 to 70 demographic. Little kids have no trouble with the Kinect. An 80-year-old has no trouble with the Kinect. We're starting to see app art show up a little bit, kind of 99-cent art, like Leah's a programmer is doing this. That's interesting. It's kind of a new market for making kind of groovy software stuff. I agree with you that there's a lot of stuff on Kickstarter that ought to be called industrial design. I mean, there's a lot of stuff on Kickstarter that ought to be called just nuttiness. But, you know, I really think these previous divisions are being erased by network society. If you're like Kickstarter boy and you're willing to throw in $100, you don't actually say, oh, wait a minute, I couldn't possibly. This isn't fine art enough. This is actually some kind of mechanical device. All right, that's an important theoretical distinction. From the point of view of whether these guys are going to get money and actually build one, it's irrelevant. It's just plain happening. It's a fact on the ground.
There is just one little question. I don't know. I think we ran out of time. Oh, there are many questions. What should we do?
Well, let's just take this gentleman's question here. Oh, I'm sorry, his, yes. We can hear him better.
Like having the previous institutions kind of fall to the wayside?
That's a super interesting question. I think it's exceedingly important to count the loss. I mean, not only do we lose our long tradition of analog art, but we're like moving onto a platform of very frail digital and tech art that we actually lose a lot of. I mean, we're like moving into an area where we reward the kind of stuff that the internet really likes. And it's part of a general social problem. You know, and there are a lot of critical problems here. I don't want to blow my own horn as a tech art critic, but I do have a Twitter feed which is called Tech Artists. It's got like 109 tech artists on it. If you go onto my Twitter feed, I think you can figure out which ones matter to you and whether you can learn anything by it. It's not an unalloyed good, okay? I mean, we're really going to end up with the kind of art we deserve as a society. And what kind of society we are is really up for grabs right now. We're like building our art tools, and they're reshaping our art and ourselves. Mm. And we're doing it with the same hectic speed as we are in the military and government and political parties anywhere else.
Right. Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, we're still here for the questions. Until the end of the event. You're real welcome. Yeah, thank you for coming. The performance.